This is David Birdsell of the Mark School of Public and International Affairs. And the first thing I do in the morning is turn on LI News Radio and listen to LI in the AM with Jay Oliver.
Hey, especially when it comes to the great Baruch College and the aforementioned David Birdsell. Nice to give us a couple of minutes on a holiday Monday. Sir, how are you? Hope it's all well.
Everything's good on this end, Jay. Hope the same's true for you as well. Great to be here.
Indeed. By the way, you had indicated you got that second shot. Very happy for you. Any effects, my friend?
Yes. I got the Pfizer, and second round was a little tougher than the first, as it is for many people, but mild overall, and very happy to be to have that behind me at this stage.
I've got it on Friday. She's a nurse, and she pretty much slept a good portion of Saturday. So, and she was fine yesterday. So, you know, a little bit of an effect. But, you know, the best part of it is, you know, you finally got the shot, you know, first and second there. So that's a good thing. All right, David, let's get into Saturday. The acquittal, no surprise, 57-43 in the vote. They needed 67. They didn't get it. You need the two-thirds vote. What do you take out of this? What did you take out of the week that began last Tuesday? When it's all said and done and you wake up on a Monday morning and you reflect, how do you assess last week?
I think there are three main takeaways from last week. Number one is that a substantial majority, and probably the 67 votes had they been cast that way, believe that Donald Trump was culpable of the charges that he was that were presented. We heard that in quite specific detail and in very aggressive language from Minority Leader McConnell after he voted to acquit, saying that Donald Trump was absolutely responsible and that there could be no doubt, and he emphasized that, no doubt, none, that his words incited the riot and brought people to Washington in the first place to have that riot. So there was a broad agreement about what the culpability was, irrespective of what the president's counsel offered in his defense over the course of largely Friday morning. They only used about a quarter of the time that was allotted to them to make their defense. Number two, that the conclusion was preordained. It didn't matter much what evidence was presented last week, that we knew what the vote was going to be, that many people had advertised their decision to vote to acquit the president, and that 67 was probably a goal that was never going to be achieved, regardless of the information disclosed in the trial segment in front of the Senate. And that was indeed what we saw borne out, in fact, despite the strong feelings of many of those voters, including, again, the minority leader. Number three is that this remains Donald Trump's Republican Party. It is very clear that a number of people, including presidential aspirants and Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, voted to acquit, knowing that they would keep Donald Trump as an eligible candidate for office. That is going to complicate their lives, but they don't believe that they can be viable candidates without catering to his base. He has proven, Donald Trump has proven, not to have much in the way of coattails. He is a very popular candidate when he's on the ballot. When he's not on the ballot, Republicans don't do so well, and particularly those Republicans who are doubling down on him and his legacy. When he's on the ballot, it's a different story. So we are now in a time of deep introspection for the Republican Party. That goes into hyperdrive now, and it's led to some extent by the seven Republicans who actually voted for conviction.
I agree. You know, because to me, it's about the individual itself in the former president and the party and midterms 2022, 2024. A possible run. He is still in play here. So it is very much alive. I do agree with you in that regard. Now, with that being said, we're going to get a round two and three here as far as what could come at this former president. I'm talking about the legal troubles just beginning. You know, you look at what's happening in the state of Georgia with criminal investigations into his attempts to overturn the results. You look at what's happening in New York as far as his business dealings. Listen, he's facing some civil state inquiries and defamation lawsuits by a couple of women accusing him of sexual assault. So he's going to get it on a couple of different fronts here. Now that the big event is over, we get ready for the sideshows. How much could they be in play about tearing him down in some sort of standard, you know, from a party, the Republican Party, again, coming into play, and, of course, a possible run in 4 years? What about the aspect of the sideshows that will now take place?
I think these are very important questions, but let me separate them into at least two categories. We could choose more categories than that, but there is legal jeopardy that he has been we knew he would be in, and he was long before the challenges to the November results really came into the fore. We knew that he was going to be challenged about the conduct of his business affairs, about claims that he made to the IRS, about his earnings and his tax liability. And although he was president when he made the allegedly defamatory comments, we were talking about behavior that preceded, in some cases by decades, his election to the presidency. So there's that stuff that isn't really about what happened around the election and leading up to the election and after the election. Then there's the basket of liabilities, relatively new, about his behavior post-election, allegedly to subvert state law. For example, in his call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, for example, in the misrepresentations on the part of Trump's legal teams of material issues of fact in front of state administrative bodies, and so on. And now, of course, calls for a 9/11 style commission to investigate all of this material and surface additional detail. Those are two areas of risk. One is clearly political in the sense that it is about a crime involving, or an alleged crime, involving the conduct of elections in the United States. And the other has more to do with, you know, sort of plain vanilla white collar criminality about the way that you manage your assets and reveal your assets to institutions, including the U.S. federal government, but also involving banks and other entities. So there's a lot here. These could be very consequential. And if we look at the non-political pieces, these are felony crimes. If these are sustained in court and if he is found guilty, he could be a felon, and that will take him out of contention for 2024 in certain obvious ways.
So in essence, there is still plenty to kind of look at as far as the legality of it all. Dodging this first bullet in a big way, but, you know, there's more to come is what you're saying. So we'll keep an eye on things, no question about it. David Birdsell is with us. Let's get to the important things at hand right now. Listen, impeachment trial, in walk, chew gum, you know, we've heard that verbiage over the last couple of weeks with this trial coming into play. Now it's down to business. As far as the rollout of the vaccine, the president is amping it up somewhat with a promise that, you know, most Americans will be inoculated by the summertime. It's kind of a wait and see. I don't know if I see it that way. But, you know, we look at everything in play right now. Do you think at this point in time we've got a pretty good handle on things? You got Pfizer, Moderna, you got J&J, the shot there, which is one that's needed here. Your take as far as the rollout, what it all means, promises to be kept, firm control. Does he have kind of a pretty good hand in this, do you think, there, David?
I think we're getting there, and the situation is improving with improved data collection, a better understanding about what we have to get to which locations in the United States. But if you've tried to get a vaccine in this state over the course of the last few weeks, you'll know that things are far from perfect. The supply is still limited. We will have more supply coming on board. That's certain. We have the modernization and expansion of the Moderna capacity at this stage, and Pfizer as well. That has yet to happen. It will happen probably in early spring, early to mid-spring, and we'll begin seeing many, many more doses available. We're going to see, and we already have seen, a more vigorous federal influence in establishing protocols and ensuring availability. So we'll know a little bit more about that. But it's important to remember, too, that when we look at that 300 million vaccinated figure, which is what the president has promised for late August, early September, sometime around Labor Day, more or less, that is substantially more than the number of people who have agreed to get a vaccine or said that they would seek a vaccine. And so I think that one of the things that we're going to pivot from when the supply issues and the logistical issues are smooth, and I do see that happening and expect to see further development over the course of the next month or two, and then we're operating at scale, at least that's the hope. It's going to pivot much more to reassuring communities that are skeptical, and to trying to persuade people who are just adamantly opposed to the notion that they should themselves receive a vaccine. Now remember, that's about 35% of Americans right now, so shy of that 90% figure, and we keep on seeing that herd immunity threshold being pumped up from mid-60s to mid-70s now to around an 80% figure, so we got to get close to that 300 million number to make that happen.
The $1.9 trillion deal, you know, we keep hearing mid-March. Where are we at with that right now? Does this thing go through realistically? Are we looking at another month here when they can kind of get it together? Where are we at with that, you think?
Well, I think it probably is another month. And that there are a whole bunch of reasons for that. Washington has difficulty acting until the 11th hour. Some of the new benefits in the December bill expire in the middle of March. So there is urgency to act by that time, and before that time, you're going to see the horse trading and the wrangling. How much horse trading remains to be seen? It seems that right now the Republicans who are willing to negotiate, and I'm talking about the Senate Republicans, heavy overlap, by the way, with that group of seven who voted to convict on Saturday, they want to see a much smaller package, and it's pretty clear that the Democrats in the House and President Biden are not willing to go with that smaller package. They need a bigger hit, and there are good economic analyses why that's true, but just keeping it in the realm of politics right now, it seems likely that this will happen. It will happen through reconciliation, which requires a simple majority vote. So if you keep all 50 Democrats aboard, not necessarily easy. You've still got Joe Manchin from West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona who are skeptical about the size of particularly the individual payments. But my guess is at the end of the day, they come aboard and this passes on a straight party line vote with no Republican support, despite the popularity nationally. And one of the numbers here that just has to be getting people's attention is that you've got three quarters of the American vote, and including a majority of Republicans at this stage, Republican voters now, not Republican legislators, who support the size and the general direction of this $1.9 trillion plan coming out of the White House. And that, at some point, has to begin to make some political dent in people's position on this vote.
Joe Manchin is the wild card in this thing because, you know, as the moderate one, it'll be he who kind of navigates the direction of it all. That's going to be the interesting part of this, you know, with the Manchin power as far as how it unveils regarding the targeting, at least, of the $1,400 deal, you know, that type of thing, because, you know, it's still about those who are in need and those who are not in need. That's going to be the big way as far as this thing turns, I think.
I think that's absolutely right. And if we think about the position that Joe Manchin is in right now, he could, in many respects, be the most powerful Democratic senator. And I would add Senator Sinema to that roster of only two Democrats. and depending on how you count, six, seven, eight Republicans. If they can be united across party lines and ask their party leadership, respectively, Democrats and Republicans, to come closer to a centrist position, they could be one of the most powerful coalitions in the history of the Congress. And one of the things that means is that Joe Manchin has to show that he can deliver, that he's willing to oppose his party when the party really wants something. If he can say something credible to the to his colleagues across the aisle and get something else out there, the $600 billion proposal, less than a third of what the president's seeking, is not a serious compromise position. But I think there is, despite its popularity among the public, who doesn't want $1,400, right? There is serious question about this targeting issue. If you kept your job, if you're doing at least as well and maybe a little better than you were doing pre-pandemic, yet you qualify for that $1,400, why does that make sense? A lot of people asking that question right now. Not uncomplicated how to make those determinations logistically, but there's real political hay to be made there, and we'll see how people shape that up over the course of the next roughly 4 weeks.
David Birdsall with us. A couple of more for you. We're not at 100 days yet. After this week, it'll be, you know, with 35 days as far as in play here. And, you know, I myself did not have a lot of high expectations. You know, I kind of, let's see how this thing kind of starts out and plays out. And I got to tell you, honestly, I'm very disappointed, to be honest with you. Because I look at these 50 or so executive orders issued by this president, pretty much all along partisan lines, David. And you're basically trying to somehow fall in play as far as the very far left wing. You are reversing a lot of the successful pre-administration policies. You know, I look at a couple of things here as far as this pipeline is concerned. The killing of thousands of construction jobs really makes no sense. I look at the illegal immigrants that have swarmed the border, invited in. I look at a time where COVID-19, in which we are finally getting a handle on things. I mean, are we doing any rapid testing of these individuals as they approach the border? I don't think they are. You know, I look at the teacher unions keeping schools closed, the school issue, you know, another Biden promise, following science, listening to experts, yet I'm not seeing it when it comes to this type of stuff. So I'm kind of still, I don't know, I don't even know if I can say optimistic anymore, to be quite frank with you. But I look at these 35 days and these executive orders and these reversals that make absolutely no sense. And I'm saying to myself, well, what's the next 65 going to bring in play here? Because that's when, you know, we'll finally have the first 100 under our belt and really kind of give a viewpoint here. But quite frankly, just from my eyes, the first 35 have not been pretty.
Well, let's roll this back well before the Biden first 35 and think about the initial days of the Obama and the Trump administrations. One of the things that we have seen in American governance, and it's not a good thing in my view, but it's an understandable thing, as Congress has become more and more of a place where good ideas go to die, particularly in the Senate, we've seen a substantial increase in the number of executive orders, and this from both parties. Presidents frustrated that they're unable to pursue an agenda with legislative approval have been issuing unilateral statements in the form of executive orders, in the form of executive memoranda, and the numbers are staggering. And we actually have to go back to the George W. Bush administration. There were more executive orders and signing statements in that administration than in the entire history of the United States prior to that time. And that trend has continued. So we've seen much more in the way of unilateral executive action. Again, it's understandable given the politics. The question is, can those things lay the groundwork for legislative support so that you actually have action that takes place in the Congress passing laws that have much more sweeping power if signed by the president than a presidential executive order, which has to conform to existing law. So we've seen the back and forth immigration. We've seen the back and forth over environmental policy, over our behavior with regard to international partners and international agreements. The real question, has Joe Biden begun to set out a roadmap that can secure congressional majorities to support with legislation many of the areas that he has staked out in the EOs? And that is very much an open question. That 100th day that you talk about comes to us on May 1st. That's when we can look backwards on day 101 and sort of see what's happened in this initial push in this presidency, and we'll have the answer. But right now, it's very clear that the Republican minority is not budging in the Senate, and there are very few members of the House, perhaps some now, and particularly in the wake of January 6th, but very few members of Republican members of the House who are willing to join the Democratic majority. So we don't know what the governing coalition looks like or if there will be a governing coalition in the balance of the Biden administration.
One more for you. Bombshell report breaking on Friday regarding the cover-up. The fact that the Cuomo administration hid as far as the number of deaths in nursing homes. And now it's all about damage control. I don't know if you can control all that could come out at this point. You know, I kind of gave examples earlier, the Joe Pococo deal, the Buffalo Billions, Link Curios deal. You know, there have been some big-time scandals, even within, as far as Shelley Silver and whatnot here. Not directly related to him, but certainly it's a bit of a mark. So when you look at this, to me, it's serious. It's one of the more serious scandals the state has seen in 30-plus years. So the big question is, what happens next here? Do we see subpoenas? Do we see, you know, an impeachment of its own right as far as the state is concerned? Do we see a stripping of executive powers here? I mean, how important is this right now? How serious is this in your mind? And the big question is, what happens next? What happens next as far as this administration? This governor is up for re-election again come next year. Far, far away, but still pertinent as far as what could become over in the next couple of months here.
Well, these are all good questions that I don't know the answers to, as far as whether, except for one. Is this serious? It doesn't get much more serious than this. We're talking about an alleged government cover-up on matters of life and death, and I use the term alleged sort of as boilerplate, but Melissa DeRosa pretty much admitted it straightforwardly, which is what set this whole train down the tracks. So we think we know what happened, but exactly how it happened and who was involved in that cover-up, we know we've had the resignations of 9 of the 10 most senior health officials in the state. Since the beginning of the COVID crisis, is that related? Is that something that's independent of the allegations here? I believe that the governor is speaking today in 2.5 hours, if I'm not mistaken, and he will address these issues. That is the point of his press conference. And we'll get some sense of what the roadmap will be and what his explanation is. You're quite right to point to earlier scandals that could have rocked or even unseated a less capable and confident governor. But this is a very capable and confident governor. So how he'll deal with this is a large part of the question. And what the facts were, is this an administrative error or is this a deliberate conspiracy to cover up numbers that have implications for federal financial aid and other issues as you have a gathering budgetary crisis along with a gathering health crisis. That's where I'm going to be looking, and that's what I'm going to be most attentive to when he speaks today at 11.
Absolutely fascinating day coming about, starting in 2.5 hours, no question about it. All eyes upon David Birdsell from the Marks Dean of the Austin W. Marks School of Public and international affairs over at the Baruch College. Great analysis, sir. We look forward to the next time. You stay well now.
You too. Thanks for having me, Jay.